actual price of the tariff, the cost, has already been absorbed by the company that's selling the stuff. So the U.S. companies are price gouging and ripping us off, but they're not necessarily doing that to pay for the tariff. So it depends on what the negotiated outcome is. Practically, the tariff is paid when it comes to the U.S. It goes into the U.S. Treasury. But who actually foots that bill is negotiated. And so far, it's been a lot of the companies in the other countries. It's never the other governments, though. Trump is wrong about that. And as far as, you know, what...
We have 20 seconds.
As far as what we ought to do going forward, so Trump is not using trade policy in a way to help American workers to raise standards. That needs to be the goal. What we need to do is actually track the actual outcomes and hold him accountable, because politically it's super important. And again, our website at Rethink Trade has an evaluator everyone can use to test these agreements as they come out.
Lori Wallach, director of the Rethink Trade Program at the American Economic Liberties Project, board member of Citizens Trade Campaign, host of Rethinking Trade podcast. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. This is Democracy Now!
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
As we learned from Nuremberg, just following orders is no defense at all. Do our American military members have a right to refuse orders they believe are illegal or perhaps immoral? Orders that may treat Americans as their enemy. Stay with us. I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
She's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
Americans who sign up for service in our military do it for a number of reasons. They're just like us, average citizens, who combine some degree of a sense of patriotism with a need for economic stability that the armed services often provide. And like all of us, people in the military also have some sense of what's right and wrong. Oftentimes, there is what's called moral injury when they are ordered to do things which conflict deeply with their sense of personal morality. Zeeshan Alim, MSNBC opinion writer, wrote these words: "There are growing signs that some of the National Guard troops, whom President Donald Trump deployed to Los Angeles, are demoralized and discontent with their ostensible mission of quashing the, quote, rebellion, unquote, of protests against the federal immigration raids. For those who are watching the how close are we to an authoritarian state meter, it's a small but meaningful indication that Trump might not be able to get all the armed forces on board in future authoritarian power grabs." End of Alim's quote. Well, currently, four times as many troops and veterans die by suicide as in combat because of what's commonly called PTSD, but it's often really what I referred to earlier, moral injury, which they're unable to resolve. Great stone monuments to the glory of war serve to silence that pain. But it doesn't work. Standing up against illegal orders may be a responsibility as defined in the Constitution. However, the current regime demonstrably has no use for constitutional parameters, that's for sure. As we all saw recently, Trump sent in 4,000 National Guard and 700 Marines, not into combat, but into the streets of Los Angeles to quell peaceful, legal protests against the kidnapping of fellow residents by armed and masked men who say they are ICE agents. And these Marines and National Guard troops lacked food or water and had to sleep on the floor when they were there in L.A. Service members are people, too. They don't expect to be treated badly or be in a position where their good moral sense is compromised. Yet, if they do exercise their constitutional rights, they are at great risk of being sent to prison and losing their earned benefits. Lots of disincentives for speaking out. Our guest today, Liza Featherstone, examines this quandary and uniquely difficult position for people in our military. Her essay in The New Republic reveals that, as the article is titled, "Soldiers Are Taking a Stand Against Trump's Abuses." The subtitle points out that on the 4th of July, members of the military called on Congress to protect service members who disobey the president's immoral or unlawful orders. And as we know from history, namely the Nuremberg trials, just following orders is no defense. Our guest Liza Featherstone is a columnist at Jacobin and The New Republic, as well as a contributing writer at The Nation. Her work has also been published in The New York Times, The Washington Post, Ms. Magazine, The American Prospect, Columbia Journalism Review, Glamour, Teen Vogue, Dissent, The Guardian, In These Times, and many other publications. She's author of Divining Desire, Focus Groups, and The Culture of Consultation, and Selling Women Short, The Landmark Battle for Workers' Rights at Walmart, among other books. She also teaches writing at NYU and Columbia in her spare time. My goodness gracious. Liza, thanks so much for being with us again.
Thanks so much, Bert. A pleasure to be back with you.
Well, in politics and in governing, personal stories are often the best for communicating and connecting with people. Your article in Jacobin and The New Republic starts with one such story. Please tell us about Kim, who, for reasons we'll see, is not her real name. Tell us her story, please, why she enlisted, and comment on how common is her experience and perhaps her reasons for joining up the military.
Sure. Yeah. Kim, and you're right, not her real name, is an aircraft mechanic, an airman, she calls herself, because that is what they say in the military, even if they are a woman. She joined the military at age 18, tough age for figuring out what you want to do with your life, as listeners might remember. She and her mother were really struggling to make ends meet. Throughout her childhood, they were even living in their car at times. She didn't think she could afford college, so like many young Americans, so she didn't apply. And the military looked pretty appealing. A stable paycheck, a place to live, food, the lifelong benefits and the opportunities that come with being really well trained and coming out with skills. She did that, she loved the rigorous routine. She had like 15-hour work days on the base. She then would stay up even later, earning her associate's degree. I mean, it was like, you know, for a young person who likes to be constantly busy, the military is pretty satisfying, in this age where a lot of, kids are like, lying around and on their phones and not being able to figure out what to do, There were a lot of rewards to it, and she loved the work. She loved learning to be an aircraft mechanic. You know, what an amazing skill.
Yeah.
And I would say that those reasons, you know, the reason for, you know, material stability,
sure,
and the lifelong benefit. I mean, when you're 18 and don't know what to do with your life, and if you add on to that the kind of grinding poverty that Kim and a lot of other working class Americans are faced with if they don't make a plan immediately, I think this is a really pretty typical experience. And especially I think for poor young Americans who are pretty disciplined and you know, high achieving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the military is a particularly appealing option because it's like, you know, the labor market isn't just going to say, "Oh, great, we love your work ethic."
Yeah.
You know, like, please start earning a living wage and fabulous benefits right away. Like, right? I mean, that's just not the that's not the way things work anymore. If they ever did, and you know, so the military was pretty enticing for Kim, as it is for so many,
I'm sure. And there's one reason why so many governments throughout history, when they're in a war, get people who are 18, 19, some of them even in the First World War, which listeners know I'm obsessed with, lied about their age because they were too young to get into it. But they did it because it's something to do. It's some, you know what you're doing. You have your identity. It's really clear. Mm-hmm. And you're getting paid and fed and housed. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
she was seemingly an average American citizen. Tell us about her reaction after she read the Heritage Foundation's infamous Project 2025. What were the fears that Kim felt?
Yeah, so like a lot of Americans too, Kim read Project 2025 with their Heritage Foundation's blueprint for the far right authoritarian government they imagined Trump could put into place.
Yeah, he's doing it.
And in fact, now he is doing it. As you know, she became more and more alarmed. But in her case, it was really personal because she began worrying that that Trump would use the military against American civilians, and she became increasingly troubled about the prospect of unlawful orders and the question of how to resist them.
Yeah, I mean, soldiers, military people are trained for combat against other states, not against Americans.
Yes. Exactly. That's exactly the issue. So the military is trained for war.
Yeah.
And in war, the other side are seen as the enemy, and
yes,
you know, you're supposed to kill them as well as possible. You know, obviously, like, they are supposed to try to minimize civilian casualties to some degree, but killing is the plan. That is completely different from what law enforcement are supposed to do during a regular peaceful protest. They are not supposed to be doing that. They're supposed to be keeping the peace. They're supposed to be minimizing the violence. Kim said, I took an oath to serve the American people. That I didn't I didn't sign up to fight the American people. She said, she said, I may not have joined the military out of the most patriotic of reasons, very self-deprecating, because that's, as we've discussed, probably a pretty normal reason that she did join. But she says, but I still raised my right hand and swore an oath to the Constitution to defend it from all enemies. Yes, to defend it from all enemies, foreign and domestic. But the American people are not the Constitution's domestic enemies.
That's for sure. Well, Trump had his unprecedented deployment of Marines as well as National Guard on the streets of America. What did Kim have to say about that? What were her fears? I guess we've talked about them a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I think that she was very afraid that they would, you know, that the Marines would turn against Americans and start killing them. But like many people, she was also worried that that it looks pretty bad. It looks pretty bad if for the military, if you're seeing the military on the streets of America being used against Americans. You know, it's just not what they're supposed to see. And Laura Dickinson, law professor at George Washington University, who I interviewed, who has a lot of knowledge of national security, military, and the law of armed conflict, has said, you know, this is really sending the Marines to Los Angeles in that situation was very unprecedented.
Yes,
you know that the federal government is usually pretty cautious about using the military domestically. You know, it's not that they never do it, but it's not normal. And it's very troubling to people in the military that she talks with, and she talks with a lot of people in the military. She's very plugged in her work, and so she says they're really afraid of breaking that trust with the American people, like seeing, you know, if Americans start to see the military as their enemy. Within the military, there's a lot of concerns about that.
Is she still in the military?
So Kim is no longer active duty. She is she took that stage toward leaving the military. But since she didn't serve her full 8 years of her commitment, she could be redeployed. You know, if they said, hey, you know, we just don't have enough people right now, they could call up people who had gone off of active duty like him. Yeah. So she's in that kind of nebulous realm. Like, she's now using her skills to do a civilian job, and she's not active duty. But I'm trying to give as few details as possible.
That's good. Yes, to protect her.
But because of her situation, she could be redeployed, and she's also very concerned about losing her military benefits.
I'll bet.
At present, she would still have them because she's doing everything right in the way that she's leaving the military. But if she were to get in trouble for speaking out or something like that, she could get a dishonorable discharge, which can really mess you up for life. In terms of losing the benefits, losing the great employment opportunities,
I'm sure,
in the civilian world that come with.
Well, dear listener, if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest is Liza Featherstone, who writes for The Nation, The New Republic, and Jacobin. And we're talking about a piece she wrote called Soldiers Are Taking a Stand Against Trump's Abuses. It takes some real courage to do that. And when I began, on the day that I began preparing for this discussion, rather serendipitously, I got a piece of mail that same day from an organization called About Face, which figures into your article. Who are they? Why were they founded? And what did they have to say about Trump's use of tax dollars to promote his macho strength on his birthday with a military parade? What were their objections and concerns? What kind of stand did these former and current soldiers take about that?
Yeah. So About Face is a veterans group that was founded by Iraq War veterans and has since included other veterans of the mm-hmm. Forever War, a lot of Afghanistan vets as well now, they were concerned about speaking of immoral orders, they were concerned about the immorality of those conflicts themselves, of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. They've been hearing from a lot of fellow service members worried about unlawful or immoral orders, whether it's folks involved in sending weapons to Israel, as you mentioned, being pawns in Trump's fabulous authoritarian fantasy of celebrating his birthday with a military parade. I think all of those actions have drawn concerns from service members.
I'm sure. And there were a few hundred military people in that parade to the king. Meant the president. And I can't help but imagine they had rather mixed feelings about being used like that and in the parade. It was not violent, obviously, but it's a most unusual thing to have tanks on the streets of America and showing this military might. I mean, you could expect it from a different Kim Jong-un or somebody like that, maybe.
Yeah.
And the flyer I got in the mail was really interesting, and it talked about Face's launching of an effort to get Congress to pass a Right to Refuse Act. What can you tell us about that proposed law?
Yeah, that's what they're working on, and that was the launch, the campaign that I wrote about was about the launch of that campaign. They're hoping that Congress will pass a law strengthening the right of service members to refuse unlawful or immoral orders. They already have some rights around this, but it's very difficult to get a military court, for obvious reasons, to agree that your orders were unlawful or immoral, so they're hoping that Congress will pass this law with stronger language, and better protections. They realize there's no chance that this Congress would pass that, but. It's not going to be a way to deal with the current constitutional crises that we're facing. When I talked to Brittany Ramos de Barros, the organizing director of About Face, who's a very courageous Afghanistan veteran who I've interviewed in the past, she once faced court martial for speaking out about the Afghanistan war. She said, it's not going to, it's true. We're not going to be able to pass this right now, but she sees it as a great way to organize military communities around what's happening, and to bring people together to help them figure out what to do, help them figure out what their rights are in this moment, how they can refuse unlawful orders if they want, and how they can perhaps organize one another to do it and support each other doing it.
And just raising the issue oftentimes, whether or not it passes, which it won't, obviously, it can still be a useful effort in a lot of different ways, just to bring up the subject and to increase awareness that, hey, soldiers are people, they don't want to do immoral things. And the right to refuse is something that we should be thinking about. And I'll tell you, as an aging baby boomer whose life was shaped deeply by the Vietnam War, the sentence in their flyer, "Military members deserve the right to refuse," reminded me of April 23rd, 1971, when Vietnam Veterans Against the War staged what was arguably one of the most dramatic and influential events of the anti-war movement.
Yeah.
Hundreds of Vietnam veterans dressed in combat fatigues and uniforms stepped up and angrily, one after another, for three straight hours, hurled their military medals, their ribbons, their discharge papers, and even a cane onto the steps of the U.S. Capitol. That was really some powerful image. There was also held a gathering of Vietnam vets called Winter Soldier in that year. That was another interesting time. They wrote a book about it. It's hard to get, but I have one. By that time, there had been many protests against the Vietnam War, but I believe this, by the soldiers themselves, was the most effective in bringing that deeply unpopular war to an end. As an observer at the time said, you can imagine the effect this had on the public. It helped end the war. And I think the GI movement, as they said at the time, exists in every U.S. military installation around the world. It's made up of American servicemen and women who have come to realize that there has to be an end, that if there is to be an end to the military involvement in Southeast Asia and end to the war, it is they who must end it. And there is a documentary of it, which I have never seen. But fast forward to the 21st century wars, the about-face flyer, I got pointed out that organized resistance from military community is one of the best strategies for rallying the public to fight back and resist authoritarianism. I have to agree with that. Your comments?
I completely agree. I mean, for one thing, service members are so respected. I mean, even as unpopular as the recent U.S. military adventures have been, and they are very unpopular.
Yes.
And I agree with the unpopularity of them. I mean, they've been really misguided and awful wars. But as much as we Americans hate the war, we love soldiers because these are people who make incredible sacrifices in the interests of us, of the public, of the American public.
Yes.
And for whatever reasons they sign up to do it, it doesn't matter. I mean, they are they say an oath to defend the Constitution. I mean, do I say an oath to defend the Constitution in my job? You know, I don't. I mean, this is a particularly unique social purpose that these people have signed up for. So, and I think people really respect that, and respect that people, you know, that these are people who could lose their lives in the service of something larger than themselves, which is our whole society. So so that's really, so when they say this is not okay with us, that's extremely powerful. And also I think people realize that the military is a formidable institution and that people resisting it are very brave and must have a good reason. You know, nobody frivolously stands up to the United States military. It's a really formidable institution, and so I think for all those reasons, it's powerful, and I think that people will want to support them, and also right. I think that it's that they set a good example for the rest of us by doing that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's what they're doing is so hard, and resistance for a lot of the rest of us would be a bit easier.
Yeah.
You know, so in some sense, it is the least we can do, you know, so I think that that's another very powerful aspect.
And certainly seeing all those Vietnam veterans who I have mm-hmm. to say, I think, they signed up for the best of reasons, many different reasons, including, you know, mm-hmm. compensation. But the fact that they saw what they saw, and they were kind of victimized by Johnson yes. and Nixon's mm-hmm. policy. They were victims. And by standing up and throwing the medals, they took a little, maybe a lot of power back to themselves.
Yeah.
And people, the American people who were not in the military, seeing that, seeing military people do that, wow. It made a difference.
Yeah.
And I happen to yeah. think now, if military people face it, it will mean a lot if you see soldiers standing up to it. And in the piece from About Face, it points out that, quote, while military members are technically required to refuse illegal orders, there's much legal gray area, end of quote. What does that mean? What's the legal gray area?
Well, the gray area is that it can be hard to determine what an illegal order is. So, for example, the law professor that I talked with, Laura Dickinson, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Talked about how, the deployment of the Federalized National Guard and the Marines to Los Angeles is unprecedented and troublesome and disturbing, and a lot of people in the military as well as a lot of Americans don't like it. But the legality of it is ambiguous. I mean, that the state of California has been litigating it. The rulings are not clear. There's not a and Brittany DeBarros agreed there isn't a clear consensus among lawyers or among the courts. So
wow.
That's just one example of how an order can have a indeterminate legal status, and many orders are like that. It's not so clear. But it's even unclear, you know, even if somebody faces an obviously unconstitutional order, it's not entirely clear what that service member should do, the military is probably not going to agree with that person that right. it's an unconstitutional order, you know, and you can be court-martialed, you can face
yes.
prison,
yes.
But then again, as you mentioned up top of the episode, if they do carry out the orders, as we know from the Nuremberg trials,
right.
just following orders
right.
is no defense. You know, if another administration comes in and says, hey, these were very illegal actions. So they really are in an untenable situation, and it is great that About Face is organizing people to support each other in this way and figure out and learn more about their rights.
Absolutely, and I think just about everybody has respect for people in the military. The people, the warriors are one thing, but the people who make the war, it's something else. That's for sure. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Liza Featherstone, who's written a very interesting article in many places, the New Republic, as well as Jacobin, which is kind of a fun magazine. Soldiers are taking a stand against Trump's abuses. That can be the most powerful protest. I mean, people ask, what can we do? Well, the military is in an interesting position because they're made up of people. And it takes real courage for military people to take a public stand against policies which use and abuse them. And you quote Brittany Ramos de Barros of About Face as saying, on the one hand, service members risk losing their benefits and going to prison if they refuse orders. But if they don't refuse unlawful orders, she said, many will live with the moral injury and consequences of carrying out something they knew was wrong. End of quote. And that is some tough stuff. And as I noted at the start of this discussion, currently four times as many troops and veterans die by suicide as in combat because of this issue, this moral injury, and they're not able to resolve it. What is this moral injury, and how does it manifest in people who suffer from it, possibly for the rest of their lives?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting. Both Brittany de Barros and also quote unquote Kim, the airman, both mentioned the phenomenal amount of alcohol they drank, when they were service members, wrestling with these issues, and those kinds of problems are common among service members.
Yes.
They feel a lot of guilt about when they do something wrong, under orders, that the rest of us, even though at some level the rest of us are just as responsible for the things that our government is doing that are terrible, this is such as to the point of your show, this is a democracy, and we did elect these people, and in some ways the rest of us are just as responsible, but we don't feel that day to day the way somebody charged with carrying out the orders does. We don't day to day think they're going to be shooting protesters and it's going to be my fault, or like they're going to be killing children in Palestine, it's my fault. Like we don't bear that, I do have some extremely conscientious friends who probably do feel this way, but I must admit that day to day I don't literally experience it as my direct responsibility that these things happen, even though it is. But for military service members, they do feel a lot of moral injury, and it is the cause of a lot psychological problems that the military will face. And and on the other side, Brittany de Barros makes the case that that you do feel a lot better when you do the right thing. She has often said that when she spoke out, even though she faced court martial, she felt good. She felt free. She felt as if she had made the morally right decision. I actually wrote about her a few years ago in a profile for The Nation. And when I was with her and on in a street fair in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, and a man came up to her who like as you were describing it, who had a Vietnam vet, mm-hmm. who had also faced court martial for wow. speaking out mm. against the Vietnam War, and you know they really bonded on this commonality over like decades apart commonality, and she said at the time, yeah, I felt that I had done the right thing. I felt really free of this moral yeah. torment. So she shares that experience a lot with fellow service members that, you know, that uh-huh. there can be an argument for speaking out yes. in terms of for yourself and yes. for your own ability to live a happy life.
And yeah. you know, psychologically, shell shock, PTSD, moral injury, people tend to turn it inwards. You know, they turn to alcohol, to other
exactly.
drugs, and oftentimes even suicide, because you know when yeah. it's turned inward, there's nothing you can do about it. And when you blame yourself and yeah. don't know what to do, but taking a stand, yeah. it empowers you. I mean, yeah, it's a risky thing to do, no doubt about it. But I think what those soldiers at the Capitol in 71, you know, it empowers you. And you get a little bit of freedom from the guilt, mm-hmm. from the moral injury. Again, with Brittany DeBarros, she's an Afghanistan veteran, as you said, and once again, the power of personal stories. You write that from her own experience, she knows that the military can make you feel crazy if you disagree with it. What is it yeah. that she experienced, and what does she mean?
I think that she experienced a lot, both as a woman in the military and, you know, some specific gender harassment and assault. But that actually paled in comparison with the increasing realization that they were charged with liberating the people in Afghanistan, and that they were doing the very opposite.
Right.
And she was a public information officer. I can't remember the exact, you know, language for the title that she had, but propaganda uh-huh, for the military. Uh-huh, uh-huh. And in the beginning, she was enthusiastic about that because she was enthusiastic about the mission. But it's very demoralizing to be creating propaganda when you cease to believe the message. I think that she certainly felt gaslighted and deceived, and she was court-martialed for essentially for turning them using the methods that she had learned in the military yeah. against the military itself. So she shared information online, told stories that were accurate about what the military was doing, the operations. They did not take kindly to this intervention, and she was discharged and didn't face any jail time. They were, I think, motivated to reach this amicable agreement with her because they did not really want her deploying her propaganda skills against the military and having, you know, sort of even more just cause, you know, and the, you know, the harsher her, the more they would punish her, the sort of in a way, the more of a platform that would give her. So I think they correctly saw that this was a better move on their part. But the military is very much of a it's not just a powerful institution, it's also a whole sort of society within itself. I mean, it's really, if you're in it, it's where your closest friends are, your mentors, the people who you see every day, and so, you know, any kind of dissent or disagreement is. You know, really difficult. I mean, it's like being, you know, it's not only your whole livelihood, but to some extent, it's your world. It's, you know, it's like, you know, if it's like if you're in a cult and realize there's something wrong, you know, and you know everybody around you is believing in it. It's very hard.
And you know, you talk about cults. MAGA is a cult for sure. And,
I don't mean to say the military is a cult, but I mean, but as an analogy, it's
sure,
you know, where everybody, you know, like there are certain beliefs everybody shares, and
exactly,
that it's such a very intense and insular
even if MAGA is not a cult, it's really hard for people who've been in there, who've been part of it, who are wearing those red hats, to say, oh my God, we were duped, this is wrong, this is un-American. That's really hard to escape from that. And mm-hmm. I can imagine for the military too. But as you say, you get a bigger platform if you get crushed, I have to say. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, for not speaking out, you know, people, there's nothing to pay attention to. If people just follow orders, then there's no there. But if you dare speak out, you know, the news media loves that kind of thing, and it tells a story, and it's exceedingly powerful. So they have that platform. But boy, as she points out, as DeBarros points out, there's no clear consensus amongst lawyers about what right now constitutes technically legal orders and what constitutes illegal orders, end of quote. But even if a service member faces an obviously unconstitutional order, of which there are many, it's not clear what he or she should do. How intimidating a prospect is it for soldiers to defy illegal orders? I mean, insubordination is fairly strong. What is it you see as the untenable situation for military personnel in all this?
Oh, it's just it's extremely intimidating. I mean, you know, they can be court-martialed. They could go to prison, in some ways, almost worse. They can lose the benefits that they would have enjoyed their whole lives, and they can face. Trouble getting a job, after the military. I mean, if they have a dishonorable discharge on their record, I mean, it is just very, but it's just scary too. I mean, it's the military, you know, if you're one person versus, you know, maybe it isn't what it used to be, but it's still one of the most powerful militaries on the planet.
It still is.
Pretty scary. And you're just one person. Yeah, that's pretty scary.
The military remains the most powerful in the world what it's doing. I think I happen to feel it's making us less secure oftentimes by doing things and making people really angry. I mean, bombing Iran and destroying, having an ethnic cleansing of Gaza. It's not going to make people acquiesce. It's going to make them more angry. And speaking out against this when you know it's not a good idea, it takes a lot of chutzpah, a lot of courage. And as I mentioned earlier, as being a First World War buff, there's this great movie, Paths of Glory, where some soldiers do speak out. And because the military brass was so afraid of anybody speaking out, their punishment was pretty strict, shall we say. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today, I'm glad to have her back, Liza Featherstone, who's written an article in a bunch of magazines, Soldiers Are Taking a Stand Against Trump's Abuses. Boy, and when soldiers take a stand, it really moves people. It really moves people. And Trump told us during the campaign that he would be a dictator from day one. And unlike his first term, he has indeed accomplished that. On top of the intimidating situation already faced by soldiers who might possibly object, is the all-too-real prospect of the Orange One invoking the Insurrection Act of 1807. What do you know about that? And have you spoken with the soldiers about possible use of the Insurrection Act, what that would do?
Yeah, I mean, they are quite concerned about that. And what that means is that would allow the president to just freely deploy the military if there's any unrest against the authority of the United States, unquote. And so that could just be simply to quash protests. A lot of people feared that the deployment of the Marines in LA was a precursor to directly invoking the Insurrection Act, but you know, Trump being Trump, he didn't really feel the need to explicitly make it legal.
Taco.
Well, opposite in a way. I mean, he did it without even, you know, doing the thing that would make it more legal. But very, very scary. And that would, the implications would be really huge for everybody currently engaging in any kind of protest. It is also pretty, the implications for the military itself are pretty intense. The Marines, as we talked about earlier, the Marines aren't trained for policing.
Right.
I mean, as Brittany DeBarra said, there may be no less equipped branch of the federal government to do de-escalation work. The rules of engagement are very different in warfare, which is what they're trained for. Laura Dickinson noted that Trump had fantasized during his first term about shooting protesters in the leg.
Yes.
That's a great example of what police are not allowed to do, but the military, viewing it as like a military engagement, would have much more latitude to do things like that. A terrifying prospect.
Yes.
The military and service members are very concerned about this, the potential invocation of the Insurrection Act, as we all should be.
Oh, absolutely, and people, I think, are concerned, rightly, about, I mean, dictatorships pretty much always involve a police state. And if you involve the military, which, as you say, are not particularly qualified at keeping the peace, boy, that's real evidence of a police state. And, you know, a lot of people think, well, what can we do? What can we do? And people feel powerless, and which serves the powerful very well for people to think they're powerless, but they're not. Public opinion does matter, and soldiers speaking out is a real powerful way to help shape public opinion and turn against what's going on. What do you think people can do? I mean, there's this. I would suggest if people want to look up About Face, it's pretty darn good. AboutFaceVeterans.org is their website. AboutFaceVeterans.org. What else can people be doing? And, you know, if they see a soldier or a National Guard person on the street, you know, to confront them and to throw things at them, not a good idea. Not a good idea.
No.
What can they do?
No, definitely don't do that. Definitely don't be disrespectful to our men and women in uniform.
Yes.
For all you know, they may be somebody who agrees with you anyway.
Yes.
Not that you should be disrespectful, even if they are not. Well, I think definitely supporting groups like About Face is a great idea. And I also think that within the military, I have the sense that they are really paying attention, even though Trump is not paying attention.
Yep.
But I think within the military, I think they're really paying attention, not only to efforts like About Face and these veteran protests, but I think folks in the military who are sensible are which are many people actually,
yes,
are really paying,
yes,
attention to the protests and the political mood in the United States, and I think it really it emboldens them, like to when civilian Americans stand up against this regime, and it also lets them know, it kind of sets a boundary, you know, that like it sort of draws lines for them that, okay, you know, Americans aren't supporting Trump, it sort of highlights for them that there really is a constitutional crisis, that there really is a huge gap between the president and the general population, I think that that's incredibly important for potentially emboldening not only service members, but perhaps even the higher up brass. Who knows?
Yeah, they're not nuts.
Right.
You know, they've been
there
for a while. They're veterans. I mean, really, literally veterans who've been there for a while, who know the institution, and are there. You know, the higher ups are there out of a patriotic sense, clearly. And so, you know, for the American public to make their opinion really known, it absolutely matters. I mean, that June 14th, No Kings thing, it was huge.
Yes.
Guesstimates are anywhere from 5 to 13 million Americans came out. That has a significant effect. And people can urge their member of Congress to support that act that ain't going to pass, but what the heck?
Yes.
Tell us more definitely about that act. What do you know the number of it or anything, or what the act is called?
Oh, unfortunately, I don't.
That's okay.
But I think if people look on About Face's website, it'll be there.
Ah.
I think for sure to support that, and absolutely people in the military are many of even the higher ups are very sensible.
Yes.
That is why they are so distressed.
Yes.
When they see what Trump is doing and how he's misusing the military. I'm sure that most of them
wouldn't dare speak out.
And I'm sure that most of them don't dissent with quite as many things as the about faced veterans do. Right. I mean, they're definitely very anti-war veterans at this point. But I think that they certainly do object to the abuse of the military and the anti-democratic and unconstitutional actions that we've seen from the Trump administration. I think it's sort of a cliche to say that the way that we keep our liberties is by exercising them, but mm-hmm. it's true. I mean, that really is one thing we can do.
And we can urge our congresspeople to support the Right to Refuse yes. Act. The Right yes. to Refuse Act. Well, if people want to read more of your stuff, yes. is there something you can point them to on the internet?
Sure. This article that we've been discussing right. is on newrepublic.com. Soldiers are taking a stand against Trump's abuses. Generally, the best way to find me is either on newrepublic.com or on Jacobin. Those are the places I've been writing for the most these days.
All right. Well, carry on. Thank you so much. Very interesting. And it's good to look at this reality of it and what can be done. This is a significant factor. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bert. Military madness was killing my country. Solitary sadness comes over.
If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free. And if you find the information valuable, your friends probably do too. Ask them to also subscribe. It's on Apple, Spotify, Substack, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Thanks very much.
Collins, and you're listening to KBOO in Portland.